Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This podcast is part of the Pardes Yom HaZikaron Yom HaAtzmaut program, which has been sponsored by Gary Carmel in loving memory of his wife, Ronit Kimmeldorf Carmel. A beautiful woman who lived for love and family, she embodied Hineni in everything she did. The divine light shone brightly through her. Her presence touched and changed all who knew her. She helped repair the world through simple acts of kindness and love. To subscribe to our other podcasts or to download other online learning, please visit elmod.pardes.org.
It's our honor to have Racheli Frankel here today. Racheli is the Dean of Students at Nishmat. Nishmat is a wonderful Torah institution for women here in Jerusalem. She's also the director of the Hilchata Institute, which is their advanced halacha program. She's a Yoetzet Halacha and was in the first graduating class of Matan's Advanced Talmud Institute. In an article about the most prominent women in Israel, it was written that she is a modern-day Israeli equivalent of the biblical matriarch, Rachel. After the kidnapping and murder of her son, Naftali Zichrono Livracha, by terrorists in 2014, she became an inspirational and unifying role model for all of Israel and every part of the political and religious spectrum. From a teacher of her students, Racheli has become an educator for the entire nation of Israel. Last year, there was an op-ed in the Times of Israel that she wrote around this time of year called, "It's Good to Live for Our Country." She was clearly playing off the very famous saying attributed to Yosef Trumpeldor, who died in the defense of Tel Chai around 1920, and who was reported to have said, "Tov lamut ba'ad arzenu," it's good to die for our country or for our land. And she turned that a little bit on its head and wrote an op-ed entitled, "It's Good to Live for Our Country." And I just want to quote the last few sentences that she wrote in that article. I posted the article on the bulletin board. I highly recommend you read it when you have a chance. But the last few lines, I think, are instructive for all of us as we enter Yom HaZikaron tonight and tomorrow. "My Memorial Day has hardly changed. It has always been mine, ours, the closest thing to sanctity that can be created by a secular calendar. It has never been perceived as a gesture towards the bereaved family, as a show of respect and goodwill, a gesture towards the victim. It's coming together around the loss we are all experiencing. One doesn't have to lose a close relative, God forbid, to feel that this date is part of Israel's personal and familial calendar. But our memorial days have never been a veneration of the dead. This isn't a culture of martyrs. We will always favor, appreciate, and celebrate life over death. It is good to live for our country. It is good to live. It is good to raise the price of life. When we gather with respect and yearning around the names and faces we knew, it is not an addiction to pain. It is not a macabre day of mourning. It's a day of renewing the commitment, of reviving the alliance. We mention our loved ones, the joy, the smiles, so they will keep living among us. Our mission is to make life here better, thanks to them. Their friendship is our challenge. Their solidarity has become our responsibility. To incorporate the memory of love into caring, to incorporate the passion into respectful disagreements, to turn the self-sacrifice into further closeness, and to turn the memory into life." Racheli Frankel.
Thank you. Okay, my English isn't as good as that. It takes. So I'm sorry. Toda rava. Boker tov. I'll take a minute. What I would like to do this morning is have some kind of open conversation. It's what I tend to do, probably because I'm too lazy to have a nice, an order lecture, but also because it becomes boring. And the biggest joy in the kind of complicated years that came after the loss of our son was to meet people and to speak to them and to have some dialogue. I consider you a very challenging crowd, so I hereby declare I do not have the answers, but I would love to have some conversation. You can ask the simple things too. You can say the simple things too. You don't have to be uber sophisticated, but I just want to talk. So the platform I'll use for talking is the story of our summer of Tavshin Ein Daled 2014, and it started on the last day of high school in Israel when my son and his classmate Gilad were on his way home, on their way home. A half a day later, discovered that that there was another youngster 2 years older than them, Eyal, that my son, Gilad was 16, Naftali was 16 and a half, Eyal was 18 and a half, and he was also traveling home from yeshiva, and they met in a bus stop and were kidnapped. That summer developed into a long search, 18 days of search, and shortly after that into Operation Protective Edge, Mivtza Tzuk Eitan. That was over 50 days, and there were altogether 75 casualties on our side. Missiles, the whole geschäft. It was also a summer that was very special in other ways, and I think I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a few more opening words. I'll just do a couple of apologies, and I'll explain what I want to do. Okay, so we'll start with like a video clip that's 7 minutes, 8 minutes, mashu kaze, and then I'll probably have a few more words to say as an opener, and then it will be on you. Okay, wherever you want to take this conversation, to me, anything is relevant, anything that's interesting to you. We don't have to stick to any specific topic. I'm also a big girl and I can protect myself. So you don't have to be oversensitive because I'll find my way around whatever is. So two last apologies. One is I'm going to disregard the fact that my neighbor is here. Hi. And pretend like I don't know her. And two is the video you're going to see was created for the Shloshim of our sons. And during that time, the search was for 18 days. It was actually 49 days after they were murdered, 30 days after we found out they were murdered. And it was the time where you just learn how to walk again and catch your breath and try to make sure that your kids are okay. So I was totally uninvolved with the creation of this video clip. It does give the narrative of the summer, at least from our side, starting with Shuvochim, my brother's keeper, the operation to find the boys, and going into Tzuk Eitan, into Operation Protective Edge. And to my taste, there's an overemphasis of the families. Okay, you'll see people saying the families. my experience, and I'm saying it really, I'm not being overmodest here, it's just my life experiences, that whenever the limelight stays for more than a few seconds on people all over this country and all over this nation, we're often in awe of the way people are coping and the choices they make, and sometimes about who we lost. I mean, it's sad that this happens often through tragedy, but I would like, as a personal favor, if you could, when they say the families, take it metaphorically. Because it should be besmachot tamid, but it could be us, it could be you, it could be anybody around here. So it's just a place full of amazing people. So that's my experience, and if you'll do me that favor and translate that when the video's on. Otherwise, we're starting with a video, then I'll say a few more words, and then we're on to you. Okay? Toda. Okay. So, as I said, we're gonna use this summer as a platform for our discussion. So I'll start with how it was by us. It's Thursday, last day of high school in Israel. We spoke to our second son, Naftali, is an 11th grade student in Makor Chaim. Makor Chaim is a special high school. It's right there in Kfar Etzion, like 12 minutes away, maybe 15, depends on traffic. And it has a tendency to be more profound than the average high school. I mean, it's teenagers and everything, but there's some chassidut there. There's a quest for ha'amaka, for deepening. Interesting place. Just so I don't have to mention Makor Chaim again, I once heard somebody ask Rav Dov Zinger, the head of the school, about the school, and what would be your ideal teacher? And he said, you know, in Hebrew there's an expression, memale makom. Memale makom is a substitute teacher. That literally means the person that comes to fill in the space. So he says, ani rotze more mefane makom. Of teacher that vacates space, that creates a space for the student. And we were very happy. Our first son was, our oldest son learned that we were very happy enough that he was there. And it was the last day of high school, 11th grade. He still had some matriculation exams ahead of him. And we spoke to him in the afternoon. For the last 2 days, they were on a field trip that was... It's actually nice because we have many pictures from the last 48 hours. And he said he might come Thursday. He used to come home every Friday morning. He said he might cut a little bit short because it's the last day of school and he's after a trip, whatever. At about 9 o'clock, he sent us a text saying, I'm on my way home. We saw it an hour later, a few minutes after 10. And we wrote him something like, great, we're expecting you, something like that. The truth is, we just went to sleep because we were very tired. But 18 days later, when we learned the timeline of the events, we realized that our answer reached his phone about 2 minutes after everything was over. But we didn't know that. 3:30 at night, we were woken up by bangs on our door. I remember waking up, looking at my watch, and saying, this can't be good. And we opened, and there were policemen from the Modin police station. It turned out that Gilad, his classmate, was in touch by phone, and at some point they lost touch with him, and they were expecting him, and he didn't arrive, and they started making phone calls to the friends, and the friends said that Gilad and Naftali left school together. So eventually they got to the police, and the police got to us, and for a few last seconds of blissful ignorance, I was walking towards his room, assuming I'm going to find them in bed. Maybe, I don't know, tell someone off for not letting his parents know. And the beds were empty. And they tried calling him, and the phone didn't respond. And we knew we were in trouble. And I was thinking of a traffic accident, something happening on the way. And Avian had, we never met, we never knew of Gilad or of Gilad's family, but he and Gilad's father met and started to drive the way through, you know, through Beit Shemesh to, towards Kfar Etzion to see if, I don't know, maybe a car turned over and nobody noticed. Eventually they get to the yeshiva, they get to the army, they're to the Chatma, but we managed to get the police to do things very, very quickly, and in less than an hour we had the last location of their phones. And the last location of their phones was in the Hebron area. And that made the, at least what genre of movie we were in, very, very clear, very, very quickly. As I said, a few hours later we learned that Eyal was on his way back home from Kiryat Arba. He stopped to say Shabbat Shalom by his grandparents, and he met them in the bus station. Two things I just want to put out here before we start talking more freely. One is, during that time we met with the heads of the army. All the names of the last elections were, you know, Moshe Bugi Yalon was the Minister of Defense, Benny Gantz was the Ramatkal, the head of the army, the heads of intelligence, Benjamin Netanyahu, everybody was in close contact, and we felt to this day that everybody was very, very honest with us. They told us, look, all options are open. On the one hand, during the search, they found many evidence of preparations to keep people long term, like hostages. On the other hand, very quickly we found out that Gilad managed to call the police and to say we were kidnapped. And after analyzing that phone call, not something they could have heard on the spot, they decided that the puffs they're hearing are shots with a silencer. And that there were weapons used. And they told us, look, it could be they were shooting just to frighten them, to get them to cooperate. Maybe they're wounded. Maybe they killed two and they're holding one hostage alive. Maybe they were murdered. All the options are possible. We're working under the work assumption that we're looking for live kids. And today I'm convinced that that work assumption, that there's somebody alive there, that every minute counts, made all the difference to even find the boys. I was waiting for my son for 18 days. I met a woman called Rachel Sasportas. Her son was kidnapped by Hamas as a soldier. She was waiting for him for 81 days. The parents of Ilan Saadon were waiting for 7 years. This is also Hamas. They were soldiers. This is the first time kids were kidnapped, but we know in the state of Israel that sometimes things stay unresolved for a very, very long time. And I don't know how you get to build, Bezrat Hashem, a happy, healthy life for yourself and for your family with this hanging over your head. So at the time, people used to say, the uncertainty is the worst. And I remember myself saying, I'm willing to be uncertain for 5 years as long as he walks in here healthy. And 5 years, you know, that comes from Gilad Shalit. But we also recently saw Zecharia Baumel come home after 37 years. So I feel blessed that we actually found the boys, that we brought them home and buried them beKever Israel and together in Modi'in. I remember standing in the place where the army brought us a whole year afterwards. There were a lot of people that needed closure. And looking at the whole area where the search took place, after through technology and intelligence, they narrowed the area. And the expression will, it's in English too, right? Will leave no stone unturned. there were millions of stones there and rocks and holes in the ground and caves and water wells and basements and homes and houses. And it was endless. And I remember standing there and first of all feeling what unbelievable mesirut nefesh everybody involved in the search had, starting with the soldiers. You know, we came to meet them. It was actually a day before the boys were found, just to say thank you for the ongoing effort. And we were saying to them, they were saying, "Ma toda bishvil zeh itgayasnu? What are you thanking us for? This is what we joined the army for." And these were young people, you know, almost my son's age, definitely Eyal's age, and they haven't slept for almost 3 weeks, and they were totally, totally devoted. And going on to their mothers that told them, "Don't come home without the boys." And for a mother of an Israeli soldier to say anything with a combination, "Don't come home," was insane. And Jews around the world, and just unbelievable. And besides that, it's Chasdei Shemaim, that it's a grace of God. It's not how I prayed this should end, but that there was Chesed here, that we got them back. Another thing, and that will be enough for me, is I think within 24 hours, I started getting phone calls from, of course, all over the United States and Europe, but, you know, Argentina, Australia. I spoke to people that live in Kathmandu. Not Chabad house, not Israeli trailers, just Jews that live in Kathmandu. People from all over the world started showering us with, mostly with caring, with prayers, with they started rallying and contacting their congresspeople and everybody doing, you know, bringing a piece of their heart into this. I can speak for hours about that. I might. I remember getting a phone call from a person that said, "Look, from the States," that says, "Look, I'm considered a non-affiliated Jew. I want to tell you, I feel so connected. I often meet someone that says, 'You don't know me, but I know you.' And I truly feel like I know them because we've been through something together. And yes, it's my story, but it's also their story." And I think it speaks volumes about who we are, definitely about who we could strive to be. Okay. This is where I get a little bit of a stomachache. Maybe nobody's going to say anything. Whatever, it's your job. No, I'll be okay. Yeah, thank you. And thank you for being first. It always helps. Thanks. Let's see. Okay, I'll start on before the on the more general level. Really, just as far as the facts go, there's an expression in Hebrew that says "ze lo chokhma." You know, it's, how would you translate? It's not a big deal. Whatever. I shouldn't get appreciation for it. That's what basically I'm saying. Because halavai, 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 I wish, Bezrat Hashem, that we would all know to give a fraction of the support that we got to anybody in their difficult times. And inevitably, difficult times come. They don't have to be crazy dramas, you know, worldwide things. But the amounts of support and physical support and practical support and emotional support, and I can't describe the hug that Am Yisrael is capable of giving when they're there. So if there's something, you know, I would wish for all of us, is this is not what you were talking about, but I'll add in one more thing. There's something in Israel that's cynically referred to as the hierarchy of bereavement. Yeah? And there's, you know, there's people killed in the army, and there's terror, you know, there's terror VIP, and there's stamp terror, you know, 2 months later on the bus station across the street from where Gilad Arial and Naftali stood, Dalia Lamkos was murdered. I don't know how many of you remember the name Dalia Lamkos. Okay, it's also it's a fact of life in Israel. But and then there's, you know, there's disease, and there's accidents, and there's suicide, and there's crime. And eventually, you know, as far as dealing with loss, we all deal with loss. I can say it both ways, you know. The pain is there, that you understand what I'm saying. But the ability to stand there for others when they need it, it just should be available. And I mean, nothing should be taken for granted. And this is a very, very, very high standard. I don't think at every point of time the whole, you know, we can do that. But even if we do a fraction of that, it would be unbelievable. And going back to what you said, so the first thing I have to say is what you're describing, for me it's lo chokhma, because we were so privileged. And I know this is a word that carries weight these days, and at least in America. Yeah, whatever. Of course, I should use my Babi's word, Moichel Toivas, this privilege, but I'd rather live without it. Going deeper into what you said, as far as anger, as you said, if you go through Tanakh, every single case of people that deal with evil, they express in some way or the other anger, or they argue, or they answer back, or the only one who's silent is Aaron HaKohen, and even there, we don't really know what's going on in his head, in his heart. He chooses to be silent. But there isn't a tradition of Lekabel HaKol Be'ahava. That's what I feel. I sometimes feel that I meet people, the kids. There's this thing, if you break an arm or you're pregnant or something, you walk in the street and suddenly you see all the other people that are in that experience. Suddenly everybody's walking around with a cast and everybody's 5 months pregnant. But so over the last 5 years, I met a lot of people that deal with loss, a lot of pain, a lot of bereavement. And I sometimes meet people who are believers, and I say believers because the group of Shomer Mitzvot and the group of believers are not necessarily Magalim Chofifim, whatever that means in English, but you understand me. The many people that are Shomer Mitzvot are not necessarily believers. People that are believers are not Shomer Mitzvot. And they, not only did they experience a great loss and they're in pain, and not only they're experiencing terrible anger, they also are very upset with themselves, they're very disappointed with themselves. How could it be that I'm angry? I'm a believer. I should be accepting this. I should be saying this is God's will, etc., etc. And I find this very frustrating because, you know, if you think everything is arbitrary in the world, there's nobody running the show. So who are you going to be angry at? It's Dafka, the people that think that there's someone in charge, that have an address to their anger, that should be expressing it. Besides, who are you going to fool? You're going to try to tell him that you're not really angry, or her, or whatever. Right after we got up from the Shiva, I got a phone call from this young woman that called me, and she said, look, I was so involved, I was praying, I was doing this, I was doing that, and now I'm so angry at the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Somebody told me to call you. Okay, thank you. Thanks. But I told her what I imagine many of you would tell her. If you're angry, go ahead. This is a relationship, okay? Be angry, express anger, if that's where you're at. So that's where you're at. I would pray for people not to get stuck in the stage of anger. Or I personally have a close friend that I feel is blocking that, is not even getting to the stage of dealing with anger because she's afraid that it will break her apart. So the things that have to be done. That said, okay, personally, it wasn't my choice, it isn't my choice. At the time, I felt my energies are very limited, and I want whatever energy I have to go to building a life that's happy, that's good for my kids, for me. I felt that emotions like anger, revenge, hatred, they seep, like all your energies are lost over them, and that it's not right for me. So to this day, I haven't been there. Mostly by choice. I remember one night on a Thursday night, coming back from somewhere, going into my car alone, putting on the radio, and feeling my stomach turn. And I didn't understand what's going on. And then I realized that the radio program I'm listening to is the radio program that you hear on the tape of the phone call that Gilad made. And it wasn't even on a conscious level what was going on. And I felt like in seconds, any piece of energy I had was gone. And it's just not my choice to go there, okay? It doesn't mean, you know, maybe tomorrow I'll go to, what, they're now 22, it could happen soon. I can go to one of Naftali's close friends' weddings. I might, I don't know, experience rage, or I'll have to deal with it when it comes. At the moment, I'm not there. And beyond that, I'm sorry, I'm taking, everything is on you. It was a big question, you have to admit. I'll tell you my mantra, okay? It goes, I can feel pain, I don't have to become my pain. I can feel sorrow, I don't have to become my sorrow. In my inner landscape, there are so many more dreams, successes, failures, things I'm disappointed with, and so much blessing. Now, a person could choose to take a bucket of black paint and spill it all over their life. I think people would understand. But in my world, it's just stupid. And I'm not judging anybody else. In my personal world. And it's a terrible ingratitude to all the blessings that we have in our life. And I must tell you, we're very, very blessed. We're blessed within the context of this terrible tragedy, and we're blessed in general. And I feel it's about, I don't know, everybody and their own metaphor, but my recent metaphor is like in photography. You can close the lens and focus only on your wound, and it's there for sure, and it could fill up the whole frame. Or you can open the lens and get a wider picture. And that includes, in my world, so much blessing that, again, I come back to saying, it's lo chokhmah, it's lo chokhmah. We are really so blessed. So working with a wider lens works for me. Okay? Thank you. I think you mature. I think, this has to be said. A lot of things have to do with, I don't know, personality type, the way you're built, and I can't even take credit for any of that because one person's built like this. So yes, I was a bit of a Pollyanna type, on the bright side of life. So you understand complexity better. You can empathize with pain with more tools. It's not like I didn't know that this exists. It's just you have an inner view on it. But, you know, there was about a year after this all happened, there was a BBC piece that spent, okay, it was, I'll tell you two things about this BBC. First is when why I was reminded. We spent many hours with the person that did the piece. And then in the end of the day, he turns to my husband and he says, "So, did you discover any new things about your wife through this ordeal?" And my husband says, "Nah." And the truth is, that's what I would answer about him too. So, we're the same people. Our life is, things have changed in many ways, but we're the same people. The other just thing, if I mention the BBC, just as, I don't know why I'm tempted, I should shut up and not say this, it's too controversial, but the piece was about the family of Mohammed Abu Khdir and about our family. Mohammed Abu Khdir was murdered the day after our boy's funeral, I think. And people were saying, there's no way the Jews have anything to do with this. And 2 days later, the police came to our home and told us this is a hate crime and it was committed by Jews. And true that the person that was the adult was a certified known mental case, and the other two were youngsters or under age, but still it was what it was, and that amongst other things they felt they were revenging our son's murder, and we were furious, and we spoke up, and we, if there's a point in time when we were angry, then we were angry. About this, about this, you know, no parent should be in our shoes, etc. About this land being like a land with a conscience, that Torah tells us that if clean blood will be shed here, chas v'chalila, we'll lose our right to live here, etc., etc. And we tried to contact the family. My brother-in-law in the Shiva managed to have a phone call with the father. After that, they became part of Palestinian propaganda. I'm totally not judging them for that. I wish I could say, I don't know what they're going through. I know what they're going through, but they're making their choices. Bisadar gamo. The thing was that when the BBC piece was made, it's fine. A few months later, I was in London, and I spoke somewhere, and a person approached me, and he said, "You know, I work as an editor in the BBC." And as they were working to edit this piece, they came over to me and they said, "Look, we have a material, we have a problem here. Could you please try and help us?" So I sat down to see all the materials before they were edited, and it turns out that there were interviews with both mothers, and I said what I always say, and Mohammed Abu Khdir's mother couldn't say Jews, she was saying Nazis. She couldn't say, it just came out really, really, really bad. And again, I'm not judging her, okay? But the BBC had this dilemma. What do we go with? Balance or truth? And eventually they decided that they can't bring the voices like that. There's too much of an imbalance. So they omitted any quote from the mother that was, it's just interesting point of view, to think about next time you watch BBC. I'm leaving that. Okay. Okay. Ken. Thanks. We'll start with the murder of the boy, Mohammed Abu Khdir. By the way, it was a very cruel murder. I don't know if there's any other type, but this one's a... I remember at the time, a journalist telling my sister, I'll have to translate this, but she said, "Isha b'shavis megana retzach." Okay, shavis is a fancy word for head covering used only by journalists that want to say such things. And she said, a woman with a head covering is condemning a murder? And we were feeling like, where do you think you're living? You know, nobody in any circle that I could even imagine in my vicinity had nothing but anger and sadness and disappointment at that phenomena of the murder. So, it's so foreign, it's so out there, it's so terrible, that I don't feel, even an ounce of responsibility for that. I feel great responsibility. As a society, we should make sure these things don't happen. Okay? But in no way in the, you know, even Shaliach through Shaliach through Shaliach, you can bring the whole Gemara here, do I have any feeling of guilt towards that? Okay? Yes, responsibility. Yes, we have to speak about it. Yes, we have to condemn it, etc. Tzuk Eitan, I hope I'll remember to come back to your question, but I remember walking in the street and a car stopping next to me, and this lady nobody does this anymore, right? She opens the window and she rolls down the window and she says, "Gevoret, hayeladim shelachem tzadikim, bizchutam gilu et haminharot." Lady, your children are righteous. They discovered the terror tunnels because of them. Now, I remember standing there, being very polite, and thinking, A, what do you mean, tzaddikim? He was a 16-year-old kid. He fought with his sisters. He was everything I can say. It didn't work for me. And then, besides, I theologically, I don't like the idea of anybody drawing lines between events in reality and specific causes. Okay, there is a general idea of lefeshpesh b'maasim and to do tshuva and etc. And I just said that the country might chas v'chalila react to us if we're not moral enough, etc. But saying this accident happened because people are immodest, or this thing because cinemas are open on Shabbat, things like this are said. It appalls me. And even a good thing like finding the tunnels, there is one narrative to that summer. It didn't just happen. But who are we to say, who are we to draw those lines? I believe someone runs the show, but in ways that are totally beyond me, and I think it's wrong to try to be there. One more anecdote before I go back to what you said. It was a winter day, and they said it's going to snow in Jerusalem. Okay, that's famous last words. First of all, in Jerusalem, if there's 1 centimeter of snow, the schools close, and I wouldn't have to go to work, and that's wonderful. But most of the time, like this one, the bottom line was I woke up in the morning and there was no snow. I had to go to work. But at that point, I thought I don't need to go to work. And I figured, okay, this is the time to do stuff that I've been delaying because it needs some falling apart. So I had a letter from Naftali's close friend, and like a 9-page letter that I must have gotten 3 or 4 months earlier, and I never read it. And I said, okay, tomorrow there's no work, I can read it now. And I sat, and I wept, and I sat, and I read, and I wept. And then I went over to Naftali's room. Now, I don't know how it is by you, but my girls have tons of stuff, okay? My boys, a couple of t-shirts, a couple of... It was the last day of school, so he packed his whole room into a bag, and that bag burnt with his tefillin and everything. So we don't have that much physical evidence of him in the house. We also don't treat it as a museum. We use his guitar, we use his jacket, we use his bed. So I went over to his drawer, and I opened it, and I was moving things around, And suddenly I found an envelope, and it had a lot of money in it, cash. And I turned it around, and it said, "Kaspei ha'maaser sheli," the 10% I put away for tzedakah from, I don't know, his occasional job or something like that. So of course I fell apart again and started crying. And then a friend of our family had just called, and I answered the phone, and I'm crying, and I'm telling him, this is what I found, and the envelope, and this is what it says on it. And he says, "You had that coming, because you said he's not a tzaddik." Anyhow, coming back to you, Tzuk Eitan was an operation to destroy the tunnels. There were dozens of terror tunnels already and prepared. Some of them with motorcycles inside, with IDF uniforms waiting for some kind of mega terror attack or future. I don't know. This is something, I don't even know what the intelligence knew about it. I don't think they just discovered it for the first time because of the boys. There was some causal effect that had to do with Operation Shuvachim. But this was bound to happen. I mean, to take care of that. So again, maybe, I hope I'm not fooling myself, but I don't feel responsible, okay? As a state, this is something we needed to do. Okay, so I'll tell you. There's a very, very grandiose ceremony. It's actually half ceremony, half party that takes place in Har Herzl on the transfer between Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut. And I'm sure you all spoke about this choice to put the two of them together. And in this country, as you well know, Memorial Day is not an excuse for sales. It's a heavyweight day, and it's not so simple for many people to go directly from Yom HaZikaron to Yom HaAtzmaut. In the ceremony in Har Herzl, it starts with Yizkor, etc., and it ends with a very party-like dances and fireworks, etc. And in the middle, there's a lighting of 12 torches symbolizing the 12 tribes of Israel. And the people chosen to light the torches are, every time according to a theme, people that are honored, actually. this year, the theme is Biglal HaRuach, because of the spirit. It's actually a line from a song that says, Lo Biglal HaKoach, Biglal HaRuach. Okay, not because of the force, because of the spirit. And the other people in the group are unbelievable, really. People the people that started Bereshit, the space, whatever, it's not really a ship, it's a thing. The people that, a girl with CP that just finished medical school with tremendous hardship and you know, a Jew's head of a Jew's doctor that's a head of a hospital today. He was the head of Chel Refuah in the army. He took care of the whole medical side of the army. People that are Olympic champions that in the Paralympics that are in a wheelchair, etc. People that did something significant, and in this specific year, the choice was they did it against hardship, against challenge, and they overcame it. Then there was the choice to honor Bat Galim, Iris, and myself, the three mothers, to light. It's the kind of thing you don't say no to, okay? First of all, you don't say no to because it doesn't sound good. It's like you're not respecting whoever's respecting you. Also, when you're a threesome, you can't do it because you're one of three. But I must say, for the first 2 days, it did not make me joyful. One thing is, yeah, coming through, you know, it feels really weird and awkward and maybe twisted to get some respect through the death of your son. But that wasn't the issue. I think in general, kavod is a dangerous thing, and there's something called kavod melachim chakor davar. You know, when a person, when you get kavod melachim, honor from people, it ends up with chakor davar. Do they deserve it? Do they don't deserve it? What about all the other people? Da, 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 da. I also felt very guilty towards so many bereaved families in this country and this overexposure that we're getting. It was very complicated. I felt we didn't earn it. The reason we did get it is because we're very, very involved in different projects that are meant to promote unity. I'll have a few minutes to speak about things that happened during that time, but Unity Day, Jerusalem Unity Prize, different things like that, and that's what got us there. I think it reminds people. Okay, I'll say this a little bit more bluntly. Personally, and I can only speak for myself, I don't believe in commemoration. I pray and I hope that Naftali lives in the lives of people who knew him, his family, his friends. You know, he was a 16-year-old kid in Israel. I don't think you would have ever met him. Okay, you wouldn't know. I don't need you to remember his name. Saying that, if the memory of that summer, if the memory of who we were as a people, has the power to cause more good in the world, to bring us together, to show us who we were, what we're capable of, what we could strive for. As long as that is still something that has vibrance, I'm here talking, okay? So I feel the reason, again, the blunt sentence is, I don't need you to remember my son, but if we could remember who we were at that summer, and that means a lot. I think the reason they asked us to light the Masorot is because we're that kind of reminder of being able to stand together, especially after a difficult election. And on the other hand, the issue of taking it to activity, taking it to trying to better things, etc., etc. But now I need to say something about what was going on as far as our house was swamped by goodwill, by prayers, by people coming with. A lady comes over, and she said she. She says, I saw on TV that you like to wear purple. So I got you this piece of jewelry. Now, I know it's not always so, you know, getting jewelry from a stranger is weird. But she wanted to give a piece of her heart. Someone from a kibbutz Shomer HaTzair, okay? Different politically and religiously very, very distant from us. He came with bags full of sunflower seeds. And he said, when Naftali comes back, you saw these seeds in your garden and you'll have these amazing sunflowers. So, not according to schedule, not with Naftali, but I remember the next year was a Shemitah, so just before the Shemitah, we managed to put this in our garden, and in the winter, there were these amazing yellow, huge sunflowers. It was unbelievable. This guy that has a whole network of supermarkets, okay, carrying his very personal name, yeah? Anybody in Tel Aviv? He had deliveries constantly coming to our home, constantly, like with Kol Tuv Haaretz. And when we called him to say thank you, he was so shy. He couldn't, no. He just did not let us thank him. Okay? You would think a person that so many things carry his name would be more of this. No, bechlelo, he was the most modest. People started writing and calling from every corner of the diaspora. Just stories that come to my mind. There's this community out in Scottsdale, outside Phoenix, Arizona, and they collected. Many communities around the world did this. They sent us many books full of mitzvot collected in merit of the boys. And they had decided to collect 1,000 mitzvot in merit of the boys. And they it then turned into mitzvot in memory of the boys. And I had asked the rabbi there, didn't people feel discouraged? And he said, no, on the contrary, people were even more motivated. And then they put out this little video clip where different people in the community said what they decided to do. So one person says, I decided to put on tefillin once a week. And then another person says, I decided to make peace with my sister. And another says, I'll kosher my kitchen. And the kids say, the rabbi's kid said, we'll say Tehillim. And then the rabbi says, in the phone call, we heard that the terrorists are saying, put down your heads. And this is our way to pick our head up strong. And et cetera. They showed me the video a few months later. It was very touching. And then, after I saw the video, this lady comes over to me and she says, look, I didn't want to say this on the movie, but the mitzvah I chose was to date only Jews. I was saying, psh, for a 16-year-old kid, you have quite an effect on generations. Recently I was sitting in Modena in some coffee shop, I was speaking on the phone, and someone stood next to me, it was very clear they wanted to speak, and we were just waiting and waiting and waiting. So at some point I said, okay, I'll call you back. And I said, yes? And she said, I've been waiting for 4 years to tell you this. During the funeral of your boys, we were on vacation in Italy. And we were so upset, we didn't leave the hotel. But the next day, we went over and we walked into a shop in Rome. And the guy says, where are you from? And we said, we're from Israel. So he says, look at this. And I see this piece of paper, it's all in Italian, I can't understand a word. So what's this? And he translated, it was some kind of publication saying, all Jewish-owned shops in Rome will be closed during the hours of the funeral. It's like, in Rome, you know, what? People, some amazing people got us to a slot to speak in the UN in the Human Rights Conference. The next thing on our agenda, some Italian Jews got us to meet the Pope. Thank God the boys were found before we didn't have to meet the Pope. They met people. Truly, people were doing the most unbelievable things because they wanted to connect, because they wanted to show they care, because they were praying, because they were hopeful, and they were. I at some point met a young woman from Toronto. She said, "I was so involved, blah blah blah," and then when the bad news came, I was alone at home, and my husband called me to tell me the news, and I was beside myself, and I was feeling sick, and I ran outside, and I later tried to understand what was I doing running outside, and I realized that any arbitrary pair of Jewish eyes looking back at me, okay, whether it was from the shul, the synagogue, the temple, who cares, that would have been family at that point. And when you're in such, you know, you experience something difficult, you want to be with family. And that realization, this is not a dramatic story, it's a very gentle story, but that realization was a formative moment for me, she says. And I can go on and on and on. When we're involved in this Unity project, so at some point, in honor of Unity Day, there's a community in New York that in upstate, that decided to have a Shabbat meal together, and together for the first time ever. And it was a Reform shul, a conservative shul, a Reconstructionist shul, and two Orthodox shuls. that consists of all the shuls in the community. And, you know, it's a Shabbat meal, so with a microphone, without a microphone, what kashrus, will they allow a separate minyan in the Reform Hall? Tons of questions, but they chose that they're going to make it work, and they invited us to be there. And I saw the people that were saying, you live down my street maybe, what, for 15 years? I never said hello to you because you're from there. And now we're eating together. They were saying there was a pillar of the community that had passed away that summer, and he cared about this stuff. And he said, wow, if he would only see us here together. And I was very curious, why could this work in this community, and it wouldn't work in most communities that I know in America. And it turned out that, and I think this pertains to this, it turns out that the rabbis of that community, their form, their orthodox, they have a chavruta together for 20 years now. Okay? And when the rabbis have a chavruta together, eventually the community feels it. Okay? Really, I couldn't go on and on, but I got a few more minutes. Ma, Tov, Ken. During the shiva, we got a phone call from a friend in Gush Etzion that said that some Palestinians from Gush Etzion would like to come, and if it's okay with us, we said fine, and we were very happy they came. We later came back to them, you know, visited them. It's part of a specific group in Gush Etzion. When I said Palestinians were by us, and somebody asked who, and I said who it was, and they said, they're almost Jews. No, they're not Jews. They're not Jews, but they're a group involved with settlers and local Palestinians, understanding that they live together and they want to promote certain things. I can't say I identify fully with that group, but I felt very happy to meet with them and to stay in contact with them. I am involved in a group that's how do you say, there's a term for it, right? When there's interreligious, yes, interfaith, that's with Israeli Arabs. Israeli citizens. Otherwise, I'm not deep into that scene. Interesting question. You know, sometimes I was given a gift of a metaphor or a pasuk or something like that. I can try to think of a couple. I will say that what goes without saying, Yofi, amen. What goes without saying in these circles, and was to say Kaddish in the funeral, was something I never stopped to think about before the funeral. This is my, thank God, my first avilut, and I didn't even remember they say Kaddish in the funeral, but when my husband and son got up to say Kaddish, I had a second to decide if to get up or not, and for 12 years I've been teaching the shiur about women and Kaddish, the halachic side of it. And I always tell my students, Be'ezrat Hashem, he'll finish many masachtot, and there'll be a minyan of 10 men, according to my view, and he'll say Kaddish. And Achrei Me'avasrim, I know my father approves of it. It was a split second, but it was very clear. I got up and I said Kaddish with him, and it felt like a very, very private, personal moment to me. It turned out it wasn't. It turned out. So one of the titles said, the woman that the chief rabbi said amen to her Kaddish, and, which is ridiculous because my husband said Kaddish, my friend said Kaddish. But eventually it was also a form of grace because many, many women from, not for the circles, but secular circles, very traditional circles, Orthodox in Israel. What goes really is not a big deal around the world was not in consensus. It wasn't heard of in most of Israeli society. And many women had told me that they connected to the Jewish side of their mourning through the ability to say Kaddish. And somehow it turned out, you know, without באמת חסדי השם, that this was a turning point for women in Kaddish in Israel. It didn't need me halachically, everybody knows. So that had to do with my studies. Okay, that had to do with the ability to know what halacha is. On the more with the things that you meant, there's one statement I got a piece. I'm not very Hasidic or Bresh of Slichaim here, but somebody gave me a gift of a couple of Reb Nachman's things that meant a lot to me. One is he has a piece on Batzar Hirchav Tali, and he says Shafilu Batzara Atzma. It's not. Literally, it means that you brought me to a wide place from a troubled place, from a narrow place. But he says, if you look deep into the trouble itself, you'll find grace there that is not available in other places. And I think there are many people going through different kinds of hardship that can identify with that. There's the piece about the difference between Atzvut v'lev shavur, okay? Sadness that actually means, in that context, means depression and being heartbroken. And he takes heartbroken to a positive place that it's like walking around with a cracked heart. It's a place you can grow from. It's a place that could develop. It's a place that could live. Contrary to that is walking around the world with a heart wrapped very well with serene wrapped, you know, like nothing's going to touch me again. Nothing's going to hurt me again. I don't want to deal with. So for me, you know what, I'll even say this in a wider sense. Sometimes people ask about faith, about a crisis of faith. I'm well aware of the psychological issues of a crisis of faith, but on a rational level, it felt irrational to me. Before, there were bad things happening to other people, and I was a believer, and now something bad touched our life. So what changed? Okay. For me, this experience was more about being very vulnerable, being very fragile, being very exposed, which is a great shiur in anava, in humility, that ends up being a shiur in emunah. And I can go on, of course, and Rav Soloveitchik, and yeah. I'll say one thing from Rav Soloveitchik, okay? If you start getting me going on learning, it's never going to end. It's that, and when you ask about my kids, don't ask me. You know what? I'll choose three things, and we'll round it up with it. One is... There's a description of Rav Soloveitchik going, he says in one of his lectures, that he goes to houses of mourners and that he used to offer them the metaphysical answers for why it happened. You know, Olam Haba, Korban Tzibur, the whole bunch of things. And he says it never works. Now, I don't know, if Rav Soloveitchik would walk into my house, my father is a musmach of Rav Soloveitchik, so I have, you know, I grew up with... At least halachically, not so much machshava, but with his picture in my mind. If he would walk into my home and offer me answers, I think I would accept them. But he said that he did and it didn't work. And obviously, it didn't work because he didn't believe it. Not that he didn't believe in Olam Haba, all these things. He just didn't believe it's the right thing to offer people in their mourning. Now, I don't know to say this for sure, but I'm just trying to say, if there's something you totally believe in, when you're approached by someone with questions, go ahead, answer them. But answer them with a question mark. Say, this is what works for me. This is what seems... Pushing answers that just make you feel better because you have something to say, to me, seems very, very problematic. So that's one thing. Amongst many other things, Rav Soloveitchik says that it's a crime to waste suffering in the world. And that's a very difficult statement, but there's a lot to it. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you know what? I'll Okay. A couple of things and I'm done. And then one song and I'm done. One is something for my kids, okay? About when we put them to sleep during that time, I remember joking with them when after they were come home, what a mess he made, and also praying, and Amalach HaGoel, and Tanarim. And when we finished Kriyat Shema, I always ended with a pasuk from Shmuel, V'Hashem Atov Be'enav Yaseh. And God will do what God will see fit to do. And at the time, my youngest son was 4 years old. I can explain to a four-year-old what this means. It means we're optimistic, we're hopeful, we're praying, but it's out of our hands. And I wanted my kids to hear it. I think at some other version it came out with God is not our employee. We don't decide how this works. About a month after it all happened, I was putting them to sleep and I was listening to them saying Kriyat Shema, and I hear them, like, I was half listening, half not. I hear them say, "B'shem Adonai Elohei Israel, mimini Michael, mismoli Gabriel." Naftali mistakel u'mal rashi shchinat el. I said, "What?" And they say, Shlomo says, "But we said this yesterday." What? Oh, I'm sorry. There's a verse that said when we say Kriyat Shema when we go to sleep, it names the guardian angels. Gabriel is on my right, and etc., etc. And they rhymed into that verse Naftali's name. They said, in order to rhyme it, they said, "And Naftali is watching," etc. And I was like shocked. And Shlomo, that was four then, said, "But we said Naftali yesterday." And Noga said, "But we repeat this three times every night." So ever since, they say one for Eyal, one for Gilad, and one for Naftali. Now, I thought this is a very cute story. But over time, I realized there's a deep wisdom here. And there's autism when they're 80 years old, they can still say it this way. It's their choice to put their... They would have never heard it from me. But it's their choice. You know, Nama, like 6 months into her first grade, she said, there's something good about the fact that Naftali died before I started Kita Aleph. I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, he's been going with me to school every day since." And again, she would have never heard this from me. But this is her choice, and this is her way. So I over time, wow, I can't stop. Over time, I realized there's a divine gift of healing. We had a negotiation team that lived with us at that time, and there were amazing stories with them I won't tell you. And one thing was, there was an ability to hear the recording of the phone call at some point. And I approached one of them to prepare me. He's a negotiator and a clinical psychologist. And I said, "Could you prepare me to hear this tape?" And he said, he didn't know the tape. Okay. He never heard it before. And he said, "Look, Racheli, what are you afraid of?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm going to fall apart. I mean, I was very focused up to now, but this is going to come from a different channel. Maybe I'll hear Naftali's voice. I might fall apart." So he said, "Okay, so you'll fall apart. Then what?" And I thought for a second. I said, "Well, I guess then I'll collect myself and get up." And he said, "That's right." And those were such simple words, very important for me to hear. And a few months later, Erev Rosh Hashanah, we get a phone call from the mother of Bnaya Rain. And he was killed in Lebanon a few years ago. And she said, "I just want to prepare you. The anxiety you're feeling now from being on the holidays without him, and anybody who lost someone close knows that there's something very scary about approaching the holidays the first time. the anxiety you're feeling now is worse than the holiday itself. And I heard her, and I understood what she was saying. And it turned out that she was right. It's not like it's amazing, but it's not what you fear. And today I put these two stories together, and I offer you this. And with that, I will end. We'll just do a song. We all have the things that we view as terrible, worst thing could happen, scary. Most of the time, most of the time, our anxieties are worse than the thing itself. And even if we do fall apart, and we're entitled to fall apart, we have it within us. It's like a divine gift of healing in my world, to heal. Sometimes it takes hours, sometimes it takes days, sometimes it takes months. You don't forget stuff, you know. It's my friend Sherry Mandel says, it's not about overcoming, it's about becoming. Okay, so you take it along with you in life, but you heal. And so that's far. I'll tell you what I want to end with. I'm sorry, I usually say things like, I can speak for hours about, and then I went ahead and spoke for hours. Slicha. Naftali's classmate, Naftali and Gilad's classmate in Makor Chayim, they had to go through 12th grade after a terrible ordeal. And their kids, and they had matriculation exams, and there were so many things they were going through. One of the more therapeutic things they did was create this song with a very prominent singer in Israel called David Deor. David wrote with them the lyrics, and he wrote the music, and it was very important for him that amongst the singers there's a spectrum of singers from secular and all kinds in the middle, and the Hasidic, and the families and the friends. It's called Open Your Heart, and I just want to thank you for opening your heart. Toda.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more online learning, please visit us at elmod.pardes.org.